Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Water quality has been a major issue for a while in Vermont, and it seems as though as much money and effort we throw at it, we don't make any real progress. Part of the problem seems to be that the decades of unabated phosphorus and nitrogen runoff into our rivers, lakes, and streams is near impossible to reverse. Well, it appears that there's some good news when it comes to water quality in Vermont. The Department of Environmental Conservation has just released its Clean Water Initiative report, and there is some encouraging news to discuss. Here to talk about what's in the report is Emily Bird, Clean Water Initiative Program Manager at the DEC. Emily, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, have you taken a look at the report? You can find it at dec.vermont.gov, and you can call us with your thoughts or questions. Our number is 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Emily, what does the report attempt to answer?
Sure. So we have a new report out. It's our Clean Water Initiative 2020 Performance Report. This is our fifth year in this report series. And the report summarizes the level of investment that the state of Vermont is making to improve water quality statewide. But it takes a results-based accountability approach where we're not only reporting on the investments, but we're also reporting on the results of those investments. So the report summarizes the results of all sorts of different projects that have been implemented across the landscape and how they're making a difference for water quality.
And you said this is the fifth year. Is it every 5 years or every year that this report comes out?
The report comes out every year. We submit it to the legislature January 15th, and it's also a great resource for the public. And so, it's an annual report, and this is our fifth year producing it.
Now, the amount of money over the last 5 years comes to an average of about $40 million per year. But has that total been rising as we get to the end of this five-year period?
Yes, it has been. And this is complementary to an increase in state funding that's available for clean water projects. Over the past 5 years, we've established a long-term revenue source for the state's Clean Water Fund. And that's included a ramping up of revenue available each year to support this work.
So how has that figure changed in that five-year period?
So the first year that we started doing this comprehensive reporting across state government, we were reporting about $11 million a year for 2016. And as of state fiscal year 2020, this past year, we're up to $58 million. So it has been a pretty remarkable ramping up of investment.
Now, you said we have, a consistent source now. Of that $200 million, where does that come from? State, feds, elsewhere? How do we put together the money each year to work on water quality?
Yes. One of the primary sources is the state's Clean Water Fund, and the Clean Water Fund receives revenue from a property transfer tax surcharge, which occurs when there's purchase of property in the state. A percentage of that goes into the Clean Water Fund. And in more recent years, we've also established two new revenue streams, a portion of the meals and rooms tax feeds to the Clean Water Fund, as well as unreturned bottle deposits from the bottle bill. And so that makes up the state's Clean Water Fund. The state is also putting funding towards this work through its capital construction bill, the transportation bill, and there's a number of federal sources that are also leveraged to support this work. Some notable sources are through the Natural Resources Conservation Service at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, as well as through the Lake Champlain Basin Program and some of the federal dollars that flow through that avenue.
Mm-hmm. So that looks at the funding source. What are the main things we've been spending this money on over these 5 years?
Yeah, so 80% of these dollars have gone into the construction or implementation of projects that are reducing pollution across the landscape. About 20% of those funds are going into efforts that help to develop those projects and conduct the designing, engineering, project prioritization to make sure that when we come to making the more substantial investment in construction, that these projects are worthwhile, well thought out, and worth the investment.
And has the focus of how those funds have been spent, has that changed over the five-year period, or, you know, how has it changed over, you know, say, the last 10 years, the last decade?
I think we are doing a better job through our planning efforts to really target how those dollars are being spent and focusing on projects that will have the greatest impact for water quality. The state of Vermont uses a scientific planning framework called tactical basin planning, and that facilitates the identification and prioritization of these projects, making sure that the state is investing in the most worthwhile projects. And I think we're doing a much better job building the capacity to for project prioritization. And also, there's been quite a bit of capacity development that has occurred with local organizations that receive these dollars doing this work. And local municipalities, natural resource conservation districts, watershed organizations, farmers, regional planning commissions, these are all the partners that we work with to get these projects out on the ground, and we couldn't do it without their support. And we've really just seen so much momentum building over the last 5 years for this work.
I'm speaking with Emily Bird, the Clean Water Initiative Program Manager of the Department of Environmental Conservation. And Emily, what are the main elements? I'm not sure that's the proper term, but what are the main elements that are polluting our lakes and rivers and streams?
Sure. Most of our water quality challenges in the state of Vermont, due to our more rural characteristics, of our snowmelt or rain runoff-driven sources of pollution. And the most priority concern for us is nutrient and sediment pollution. So, for example, phosphorus flowing into Lake Champlain, causing a phosphorus imbalance in that lake, leads to harmful and sometimes toxic cyanobacteria blooms. Or the eastern part of the state, the Connecticut River Basin that drains to Long Island Sound, we're really concerned about nitrogen and the impact of nitrogen on waters that flow into the Long Island Sound, where the nitrogen imbalance there causes low dissolved oxygen, which makes it really hard for aquatic life to survive. So generally speaking, we are aiming to target those sources of nutrient imbalances, the phosphorus and nitrogen. And then also, if you can picture some eroding soil, the sediment associated with that can cause some of our water quality challenges as well. So all of these clean water projects that we're investing in with these funds are targeting nutrient and sediment pollution. But they also come along with a number of other additional benefits. These projects not only protect the environment, but they offer economic and social benefits, like protecting against flooding, protecting public health and safety, improving fish and wildlife habitat. And all of this also promotes some of the recreation-related opportunities in the state that support our economy. And I think many of us Vermonters have turned to outdoor activities throughout this pandemic, and having clean water and opportunities for paddling and swimming have proven to be a pretty essential resource for socially distant recreation during this difficult time. There's just so many different benefits associated with these projects in addition to helping to improve water quality.
Absolutely. Point well taken. What are the major sources of these pollutants, Emily?
Sure. These projects are being targeted across all of the land uses in the state. And we boil that down into a handful of categories. So we have agricultural sources, sources from developed lands like paved surfaces and roads and the erosion alongside those paved surfaces. We are also targeting improvements by restoring our natural resources, like rivers, floodplains, wetlands, and lakeshore areas. And then, of course, there's the wastewater treatment facilities and reducing the pollutants from the wastewater sewer systems in our state.
That's
sort of a high-level overview of the major sources.
Yep.
And these projects are being implemented across all of these land uses to address these issues. And I mentioned a little bit earlier that because of Vermont's more rural characteristics, so much of the pollutants are transported by rain runoff and snowmelt, mm-hmm. and it flows across the landscape into our waterways. And so it really requires a similar approach in terms of having these projects spread across the landscape to intercept those pollutants.
Emily, have we been able to reduce pollution by spending this $194, $195 million?
Absolutely. At the same time we were setting up all of this funding, the state put into place a pretty robust tracking system that provides us with data on the results of these projects. And over the past 5 years, state-funded projects have reduced pollution for more than 90,000 acres of agricultural land, 200 municipal road miles, 332 acres of impervious hard or paved surfaces. And in addition to that, the state has restored 290 acres of land adjacent to rivers, floodplains, lakeshore, and wetlands, and conserved more than 1,200 of those acres as well. So we know that these projects are making a difference, and I can also provide a little bit of context with regards to Lake Champlain.
Sure.
We are about 5 years into a 20-year restoration plan for Lake Champlain. And Lake Champlain suffers from a phosphorus imbalance that leads to harmful, sometimes toxic cyanobacteria blooms that causes beach closures and are pretty unsightly and sometimes very dangerous as well.
Right.
And based on the projects that we've been able to fund and track working across state and federal funding programs and regulatory programs, those projects we estimate have intercepted over 62,000 pounds of phosphorus. And so that's a pretty remarkable accomplishment, working together across state and federal government to be able to provide that result. But to give a little bit more context, that represents about 13% of the phosphorus reduction that we need to accomplish in order to restore Lake Champlain. But the good news is I think this is about where we'd expect to be at this point in time. We have some major funding and regulatory programs that are in the process of continuing to ramp up, and we anticipate that those results and phosphorus reductions will ramp up significantly in the coming years. And the good news is we have these tracking systems in place, so we can use that as a feedback loop to also identify where we need to do more, how to better target resources through our planning efforts. And I do feel we are on the right track.
And Emily, that 13%, is that for, you know, over the five-year period, or is that from year to year? What does that represent, that reduction in phosphorus going into Lake Champlain?
That represents our cumulative efforts over the last mm-hmm. 5 years.
All right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so looking back 5 years ago, you know, this is a net loss of 13% of phosphorus going into the lake. Was it rising at that time when we did our first report, or do we know? I know the measuring seems to be more recent, but what did we know 5 years ago?
This is estimated reductions based on the projects that we are putting out on the landscape. You bring up a good point that there are other factors out there on the landscape that will affect our ability to reduce phosphorus to the lake. So you may recall Tropical Storm Irene and some of the major flooding events. That was a major source of phosphorus loading to the lake. The phosphorus loading to Lake Champlain is highly correlated with rain and precipitation.
Right.
And so each year, We are monitoring the actual phosphorus loading to Lake Champlain to see how close we are to meeting the targets. And so about 5 years ago, we are seeing a fluctuation year to year in phosphorus, highly correlated with the flow of precipitation. And so ultimately, we're not there yet in terms of reducing that phosphorus loading into Lake Champlain to where we want it to be. But we do anticipate that as we get more projects across the landscape, those projects will intercept more of that phosphorus. And we're keeping an eye on some of those external variables affecting our progress as well. That's addressed in this report. We will continue to make progress heading in the right direction. But it is important to note, Lake Champlain is a huge water body, and it was degraded over the course of decades, and it's going to take time for these larger water bodies like Lake Champlain to recover. And that really highlights the importance of long-term investment, continued stewardship, and every land steward across the landscape doing what's best for water quality and adjusting our land use practices accordingly.
And the good news is they can, if we treat them properly, they can recover. And that is good news as well, Emily. We've been talking kind of big picture and yet looking at numbers, but let's get specific now. Maybe give me a couple examples of projects that the state has put into place to help reduce this pollution.
Sure. I think that there's a really impactful example of a project in the natural resources section of our report where you can see before and after the removal of the Cold Spring Brook Park Dam in the town of Weston. It's pretty remarkable to see these large dams that are blocking aquatic organism passage and sometimes are hazardous. And when they are removed in a well-thought-out manner, of course, it really restores the river to its natural state, giving the river the space for the floodwaters to spread out into the floodplain and giving it the space to meander naturally. And that's one of the best things we can do for water quality, is restoring the altered landscape back to its natural state where we have the ability to do so. That's one of the most cost-effective approaches, is natural resource restoration. And we also have a lot of work playing out in the developed land sector, where municipalities are hard at work to implement the Municipal Roads General Permit Standards. Many of us, I think, go on our scenic Vermont drives, especially during the pandemic. And while you are driving along a road and you notice that stone-lined ditch along the side of the road, that is implemented by municipalities to help prevent roadside erosion and giving the rain runoff a place to go and settle out before it flows off into the adjacent landscape. That's an example of a project that you can see statewide on many of these roads. We also have an example where a lot of schools are installing what we call green stormwater infrastructure next to their parking lots or other hard surfaces on school properties. And there's a great example in the report from the Hays and Union School in Hardwick, where we've installed a gravel wetland where stormwater runoff can flow and go through a treatment process to remove phosphorus and sediment from the runoff. And these gravel wetlands, once they're established, they kind of look like a wetland with natural vegetation, and they can be pretty beautiful to the eye as well, and a nice feature for our landscape. So those are just a few examples of, these projects are everywhere if you know where to look, and they are making a difference for water quality.
We've ascertained that the spending has been rising significantly over the past 5 years. So what is projected to be spent over the next five?
Yeah, we do anticipate that we will keep up this level of investment. I think we are getting up to the Clean Water Fund revenue has ramped up over the last 5 years, as I mentioned earlier, and it's getting up to the level where we expected it to be. So I think we're going to continue to maybe have a little bit more ramping up of funding, but we are, I think, at that long-term adequate funding level where we had hoped to be for our water quality efforts in the state. Of course, we will continue to monitor that, and where it is not enough, you know, look for opportunities to raise funding to support this work. You know, it's a collaborative process across state and federal government to support this work. But the other piece is that the economic impact of the pandemic has had some impact on revenue, and so we are continuing to monitor that and adjust budgets as needed. And in doing so, trying to maintain these programs as best we can with as little impact as possible to the work.
Fair point. What are the major concerns we have regarding water quality in the state going forward, Emily?
I would like to highlight that these projects are becoming part of our infrastructure. And that's really great news because of all the benefits they provide. But we need to make sure that we are maintaining this investment. And our team is developing some operation and maintenance protocols to ensure that there's consistent maintenance of these projects long-term so that they continue to perform and produce these results into the future. And I think that maybe one of the next phases of this effort is really better standardizing the maintenance of this infrastructure and developing the workforce to go along with that. And then I'd also like to highlight that there was an act of the legislature in 2019 that restructures how we allocate funding to clean water projects. And those new funding programs are going to take effect July of 2022. And that involves really ramping up our efforts to target non-regulated sources of phosphorus through watershed-based organizations called clean water service providers. And we're really looking forward to partnering with those service providers to make a lot of progress in areas of the work, natural resources restoration. And then complementary to that, there's going to be some enhanced funding programs available to help municipalities and other landowners to comply with stormwater regulations. So that's sort of maybe a sneak peek to what's on the horizon for our water quality work.
I love it. Thanks, Emily. Emily Bird is Clean Water Initiative Program Manager at the Department of Conservation, and you can find the Vermont Clean Water Initiative Annual Performance Report at dec.vermont.gov. Emily, I appreciate your time this morning.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
It was mine as well. We'll be back in a few minutes, and then we'll be talking about some outdoor adventures you can go on in that lovely environment that Emily told us about. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we're raising our hats to the good presidents past and present with a sale. 20% off all men's and women's fall winter clothing. Our deli is pumping out amazing deliciousness with old favorites like the number 6 and some new specialties like the best Reuben anywhere in Vermont. The grab-and-go dinners are a great value, generous full-course meals for two. Check out warrenstore.com for weekly menus and to order online. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. The Warren Store in Warren Village is open 7:30 to 5 daily, practicing all COVID protocols.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. If you've been hearing about how Vermonters are getting out there and enjoying all these great outdoor opportunities, but you're not sure exactly how to start doing them, what equipment you need, where to go do them, or if you're going to actually enjoy them, what do you do? Or if you're getting visitors, it still happens and it will happen again. They want to take part in an activity like dog sled racing that you haven't got a clue about. Where do you go? Well, I've got a guy. Actually, we all do. He's Michael Porcelli, Program Director for Umiak Outdoor Outfitters, and he joins us now. Michael, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick. How you doing today?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Good, sir.
Good. And listeners, you can give us a call with questions or suggestions, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. All right, Michael, if I didn't have you, you know, inside, tied to this phone call right now, what would you be doing outside right now?
Well, right now we're getting ready to do a Nordic instructional tour, so that's going to be heading out at 10 o'clock, and that's a 4-hour instructional Nordic skiing tour mostly for beginners, never evers, that kind of thing. Just getting familiar with the gear, learn how to kick and glide, making some little turns, learn how to fall down, learn how to get up, that kind of stuff. So that's going out here in just a few minutes, and then I believe we have a snowshoe tubing tour this afternoon. So. Yeah, we've got a lot of stuff going on.
Oh, man, snowshoe tubing. That sounds like the greatest thing on earth. And, when you mentioned the Nordic and you kind of said this one's for beginners or never bins, do you have levels generally when you have these activities that you make sure that, like, someone is in the proper group that you're taking them out in?
Yeah, exactly. And this year's a little different because it's we're not open enrollment. We're only private tours, so everything due to COVID. So once someone books their group or a single or a couple, it's just them and the instructor or my guides, and that's how it goes. You know, due to COVID this year, we had to change things up. But generally, yes, it's an open enrollment program, and we do vet everyone to make sure that we don't have, you know, people that want to get out in the deep snow and the trees, and then someone who's never been on skis before at all. So we always try to make sure they're properly melt together.
I gotcha. And we're gonna go to all the seasons because you've got these activities booked for all seasons at Umiak. But I want to stay in the current season. You mentioned a couple already. They're going out today. What are a few more that you have going on this winter?
Yeah, so our snowshoe tubing tour is our biggest seller the last few years.
Tell us what goes on that one. I don't want to get off that too quickly. That sounds too great.
Yeah, so basically what happens is you show up here at the shop and we take you to a private area we don't like to talk about, but we don't tell people where it's at. But yeah, so we take you down and we do a really nice snowshoe, through the woods on a trail, and interpretive talks all along the way, you know, the history of snowshoes, the history of the area, flora, fauna, that kind of stuff. And we come out to this beautiful peninsula looking down the lake towards the Green Mountains. It's absolutely gorgeous. And then, you know, and then from there, take a bunch of pictures. And then we come around towards the sledding hill. And then we have Cold Hollow, hot cider and jams and jellies and crackers. And then it's old school. You know, you're hiking up and tubing down, and just everyone loves it. Kids, adults, everyone just has such a great time. And then, you know, it's about, you know, 3 hours, and then you're back here and you're off enjoying the rest of your day.
Wow, that sounds phenomenal. All right, I cut you off. I had asked a question about others that you've got going for the winter, and then I made you give me more details about the one I love. But what are some other winter activities that you have at Umiak?
Yeah, I mean, we have so many. I mean, I definitely recommend anyone wanting to know in-depth more, go to our website, umiak.com, mm-hmm. UMIAK.com. But we have a Moonlight Cabin snowshoe tour where we take you out again with interpretive talks. We come to a restored sugar shack, which was an old maple syrup, where they cook maple syrup.
Yeah.
And, there's a fire going in the fireplace. And again, we put out, you know, cabbage cheese and crackers and Cold Hollow hot cider. And, you know, we also are partnered with the Stohoff Inn gourmet fondue snowshoe tour. We leave from the Stohoff and end at the Stohoff with your snowshoe tour, and then you have a three-course fondue dinner, which consists of soup of the day at first, cabbage cheese fondue, and then Laughing Moon chocolate, which is our local chocolatier here in Stowe, for dessert. So, yeah, it's awesome.
Wow.
That's a good one. We also have expanded operations down into the valley, which is down towards Waitsfield, Mad River. And we're partnered with the Featherbed Inn. We do it's called a chilly evening snowshoe tour. So we take you out snowshoeing, and then we end at our teepee, got a fire going. And then the Featherbed Inn provides their famous chili, vegetarian or meat, as well as brown butter, cornbread, and a homemade brownie for dessert, as well as Cold Hollow hot cider. And then we are also in the valley doing a slip, slide, and dine tour, which is partnered with the 1824 House, and it's pretty awesome. It's no snowshoeing, but just tubing and sledding on their big hill out behind, and then you also get lunch from them, which is included in the price of that. And then we have all kinds of backcountry ski tours. We do, you know, all kinds of stuff. Stowe tasting tours, which we do breweries, you know, anything custom, cideries, breweries, distilleries, as well as, you know, we might throw in a waterfall or a covered bridge. That currently is on hold just due to COVID, but we'll be bringing that back hopefully come summertime. And then dog sledding as well. I know that's a big one for us for sure. And we have two versions of that. We have the evening quick ride, which is awesome. Kids love it. It's great for younger kids, older kids, kids my age, you know. And then we have the two-hour tour down in the Mad River Valley as well, which is a little more in-depth, a little more hands-on. But everyone loves it. We got a lot of stuff going on.
Michael, do they just put you in a room and say, okay, go in there and think of the sickest, most fun activities with the best food possible tied in, food and drink tied into it, and then come back with another list and we'll, you know, we'll be doing those next week?
Well, I'm not alone in this. Believe me, there's a whole crew. We have a great staff here, all my guides, my coordinator, Matt, he's awesome. Our marketing lady, Emma, she's just amazing. The owner, Steve, everybody here, we all work together and work hard. So,
and who goes on these adventures, Michael?
Everyone, locals, you know, tourists. Obviously, we get a lot of tourism here in Stowe. Not so much due to COVID, but that's okay.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, we get people from all over the world, honestly. I mean, we've had people from Australia, people from the Caribbean, you know, we've had people from China, I mean, just in the entire world. So, you know, from right down the street to halfway across the globe, everybody likes to come to Stowe. And when they do, you know, we're the outdoor store here and, you know, fun times to be had.
And why would somebody who's right down the street need to or want to go on one of these adventures and not just go do their own?
They can. We do rentals. So a lot of people just come. They'll rent tubes and go to the local sledding hill. A lot of people just, you know, rent snowshoes, and we point them in the right direction, give them trail maps to some of the Stowe Land Trust areas. And, you know, a lot of people want that hands-on, that intimate feel with a guide explaining things to you and giving you that knowledge of how to use your equipment, and especially on the ski tours, you know, that's something like, if, you know, a lot of people have been downhill skiing, but they never used AT equipment. They've never been in the backcountry using skins. So that's something that we provide, you know, instruction and how to be safe in the backcountry. So
who are the guides, Michael?
Oh, I have a lot of guides. There's too many to mention.
Asking for a full list, but
I get it. My lead guy, Chad, he's awesome. He's been with me for 6 years. He's also a ranger at the local state park. But you know, all our guides are all at least CPR and first aid certified. Most all of them, I think everyone this winter is woofer, which is a wilderness first aid, or wilderness first responder. So, you know, they're just guys and gals. They're all awesome, and they're all really knowledgeable. And that's part of it, is just keeping my staff safe, keeping the customers and clients safe. It's just that's the biggest part of it, I think, is the risk mitigation. And especially with COVID now, you know, we have a lot of protocols in place that, you know, other people may not, but we're doing it just to keep our staff and our guests safe. And, you know, it takes a little bit extra, but we have to do it. And then times change, and that's what you got to do.
And before somebody shows up, do they get a list of what equipment to bring, what incidentals to have with them?
Oh, yeah, of course. So when we make a tour, we book someone, we give them the confirmation email, and the confirmation email gets to them. It says how to dress properly, what to bring, you know, obviously bring water. But we also, my guides also always have backup stuff, whether it's gloves, hats, hand warmers. They're always prepared for the guests that may not be prepared, even though they got the email. And that's fine. I mean, we get it. You know, some people have never seen snow when they, you know, they come here and this is the first time they've seen snow. And,
oh, man.
You know, it's like, hey, but we're always prepared for that in those instances. So, we do our best to keep everyone safe and sound, for sure.
And let's go to the phones and talk to Frank in Burlington. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning. I wonder if Michael has an email address where I can go online and get all this wonderful information he's talking about.
Yeah, Frank, so you can go to umiak.com, so UMIAK.com, and you can see all of our tours, summer, winter. Right now, obviously, you'd go to winter activities and see all of that fun stuff, rentals, everything else. And then if you did need to email us, it's programs@umiak.com, and that'll get right to me or one of my staff members, and you'll be all set with any questions that you have. Or you can call us at 805-802-253-2317.
All right. Thanks so much, Frank. No, go ahead.
The email address again?
It's programs@umiac.com.
I mean, your website, I'm sorry. Website.
Oh, website's www.umiac.com.
UMIAK.com.
You got
yes,
it.
Sir.
Thanks, Frank. All right, so, Michael, is there anything that you hadn't done before, went on one of these activities with UMIAC for the first time?
Personally, myself, Rick? No,
yeah.
I've done them all. I started here as a guide years ago and then, you know, became the coordinator and then became the director. And, you know, it's been a great time and, you know, love working here.
I can tell.
It's a big kid job.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to the spring. We've done winter quite well, and spring's coming up. What are some, then, as the weather turns a little bit warmer, that you do there at UMIAC?
So once, you know, we end winter activities, you know, again, we have all kinds of fun stuff going on. We're partnered with a bunch of different people, Vermont Farmhouse Jerky, Sherry's Trail Bars, Cold Hollow Cider. But once spring comes around, we start doing our training for summer, obviously. You know, we do have three outposts right now. As of right now. We have one on the Winooski River, one on the Lamoille River, and one at Waterbury Reservoir. We rent kayaks, paddle boards, canoes. We do all kinds of instructions. So we can teach you from beginner to expert. We can still teach all of those, you know, those disciplines. And then we run tours. You know, we're partnered over on the Lamoille River. We're partnered with Bootlegger Bikes out of Jeffersonville. So, you know, due to COVID, we found that we needed to come up with something that maybe people didn't want to be in a bus and get shuttled up river. So we've partnered with Matt at Bootlegger Bikes.
Oh, wow.
Basically, you walk across, you park your car, you walk across the covered bridge. Yeah, get on an e-bike or a regular, you know, road, a kind of mountain bike. It's actually a hybrid, but you get on the Lamoille Valley Rail Trail. You pedal upstream past our outpost, and then you come back to our outpost, and then you jump in a boat and you paddle down, or, you know, boat, canoe, kayak, and you paddle back down to your car. So you're never enclosed in the vehicle. And people just loved that last year. So, you know, we were partnered with Boyden Valley Winery as well. So you would do your paddle, and then you would go to Boyden. I'm hoping that happens this year. Last year, Boyden was closed due to COVID. But, right. You know, so, and then on this side, the Winooski River, you know, we're partnered with Cold Hollow Cider Mill, obviously. So you can do a cider tasting after your paddle as well. So. Got a lot of fun stuff going on.
That is great fun.
As well as rentals. Again, you know, we rent canoes and kayaks and paddle boards. And the instruction aspect is a big part of it. You know, people have never been on a paddle board. They want to learn how to brace and, you know, do some, you know, turns and stuff like that. So we're there for anyone who needs instruction, beginner, intermediate, expert. We can do it all.
What kind of feedback do you get from participants of these things?
You know, people love it, especially, you know, our guides are, you know, they're just awesome. They're, you know, it's really, you know, I wouldn't say hands-on due to COVID, but it really is hands-on. It's a kind of a one-on-one or a couple or even a family. They'll come together. They'll get with our guide. They'll go out on Waterbury Reservoir. They'll learn how to kayak or paddleboard or canoe. And, you know, it's just people eat it up. They love it. And you're getting outdoors and you're having fun and you're making memories, you know, that'll last a lifetime with your family. I mean, how do you beat that?
Yeah, no kidding. Okay, what's the most adventurous of the adventures? The one that, you know, people might have to have some real experience or be a serious adrenaline junkie?
They're all fun, and they're all, you know, all of our tours get you that outdoor excitement, that adrenaline going. But if I had to say one in particular, I probably would say our backcountry AT tour. We take you out to an area here in Stowe that's backcountry, and it's, you know, you're learning the gear and everything, but you're out there. You know, we have our guides are equipped with, you know, first aid kits, everything for risk mitigation, including a Spot X, because there is no service out there. So we have a GPS system that, you know, in case anything were to happen, we are right there and have all our bases covered. But that one's awesome. The pictures and the smiles of everyone that comes back from that one, it's pretty, It's pretty awesome. The snowshoe tubing tour is great, too. I mean, all of our tours, you know, you're just getting out there and having fun, and that's what it's all about, enjoying the outdoors, learning things, and getting introduced to things that you may not know living down by the city or living in the suburbs.
All right, let's go back to warm weather, maybe something that happens in the summer that we haven't talked about, an adventure you have then.
So we also do tubing in the summer.
Right.
We're going to be expanding that a little bit more. We're hoping to actually be able to do some shuttle service for tubing, but we rent tubes for people to go down the rivers, and that's been a big hit the last few years. People are just loving it. Our Richmond store opens generally right at Memorial Day. And that's a big one down there, so we're going to be pushing that a little bit more this year to be able to rent tubes and boats and whatever you need to get on the water down in Richmond as well as here in Stowe.
Mm-hmm. How about any hikes?
So hikes, we have trail maps, and we, you know, especially in winter, we'll take people out. We'll do some hiking tours towards like Moss Glen Falls, up towards the Pinnacle. Generally, it's more renting snowshoes, giving them trail maps, and letting people kind of do it on their own.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about expanding to maybe doing some stuff like that, some overnight stuff, but as of yet, especially due to COVID, we have not implemented that.
How far in advance does someone need to book one of these activities, Michael?
Obviously, during holiday season, like I'm fully booked for dog sledding, both sets of dog sledding for President's Week. I would say midweek, regular time, not a problem. You can call a day or two before, but Christmas, Martin Luther King, President's Week, those holiday weeks, and then Memorial Day, 4th of July, Labor Day. Those weeks, you definitely want to, you know, reserve anything you want to rent or tours that you want to do, definitely, you know, at least a few weeks in advance, just because it just fills up so quick.
All right. There's another one. I guess this would be year-round, is animal tracking. Sounds like an interesting activity.
So basically that coincides with all of our tours. So all of my guides, the guys and gals are just really good at animal tracks, flora and fauna. History of, you know, snowshoes, history of maple syrup, as well as, you know, on a clear night on any of our evening tours, my guides are really good at stargazing, so we'll take you out. If it's really clear, we start pointing out constellations and stuff like that, and people just eat it up. It's awesome. I've done it with my guides, and they're just so good. I can't be more proud, especially with COVID and then these things nowadays and the precautions we have to take and the extra steps that we have to do to sanitize all of our gear and mm-hmm. protocols that we've put in place. My guides have definitely stepped up and they're really taking care of themselves as well as the guests.
All right, I'm going to throw one more out there. We've talked about dog sled racing, but dog karting, what exactly is dog karting?
So dog karting is a summertime activity. It's definitely different. It's a cart, you know, that has like ATV wheels, and the dogs are pulling. Much less time in the cart or the cradle, as we call it. But you know, it's pretty awesome. it's dog sledding in the summer.
Right. Are the dogs happier to do that than they are the dog sleds in the winter?
Well, the dogs love wintertime. Let me tell you, they just eat it up. They can be out there all day. They just love running, and wintertime is their time. Summertime, they love it because they get to go and then jump in a pond or something like that. Winter, the dogs are all about the wintertime.
I love it. Michael Porcelli is the program director for Umiak Outdoor Outfitters. You can find their programs at umiak.com. Michael, thanks for being on with us and taking us out to some great adventures this morning.
Hey, Rick, thank you so much, and stay safe out there, everybody, and enjoy the outdoors.
All right, you too. CBS News is next. When we return, we're going to have some more open phones. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let's celebrate Valentine's Day at the Warren Store with a very special meal created by our culinary experts. Check out warrenstore.com for details. We have a great assortment of cards and gifts and chocolate-dipped strawberries. Upstairs, we have puzzles, journals, art supplies, and candles to warm and while away the winter days. Dress yourself in cozy tops, snuggly sweaters, and happy colors. You can now order online from the deli at warrenstore.com. Warren Village is a winter wonderland, so come to soothe your soul, fill your tummy, and dress your body. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, open 7:30 to 5.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. I might as well give the phone numbers right off the bat. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Yep. No guest again for the next half hour. Well, this time it's not completely my fault. Whatever. Yeah, I was trying to fill this slot and then learned that the impeachment show was going to possibly happen today and that it might probably would wipe out some of this show. So what do I do? You know, book someone only to tell them, never mind, and leave them in the virtual green room. So I played it like the kid who's got a test the next day but is listening to Roger Hill and betting on a snow day to buy an extra day of non-studying. Oops. Yes, it's open phones again. Yes, for the second day in a row. So here's the topic if you want to play along. And you can just call about anything, but if you want to play along, here's the topic I'm going to throw out there. We've been unable to get out and enjoy live music events for most of the pandemic. So let's talk about concerts. It can be the last one you attended, the best one you attended, the worst, one you had tickets for that got scrubbed, who you're going to take, make sure to see once that, we're freed from our cages and can go back to seeing concerts. Who'd you like to see live again? Or you can call to talk about whatever you'd like. We heard from an interesting guy named Leon yesterday. He was working on a history of the Vermont State Police. That was a cool revelation. And if you've got something like that, feel free, call in, book suggestions. Numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And, of course, if you don't call, I just keep talking. And that's not the greatest way to spend your next half hour. Trust me. All right, again, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can ask, you can opine, or you can tell us all about concerts that you can't wait to see, that you have seen, that were really fantastic, your first ones. We'll make that the topic du jour, but again, you can go off script whenever you'd like. You can sell something on the Trading Post. You can list something that you're looking for on the Trading Post. We're just going to open up the phones at 244-1777, 877-291-8255, and you'll help me get through this next half hour, hopefully. All right, you've got the numbers, the email, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I will tell you that, it's so funny. It's been so long ago. 44 years maybe since my first concert. So I know I went to two that summer, and so my first one was either Foreigner on their debut album tour or Supertramp. They were touring on Even in the Quietest Moments, and I know I saw them, both of those, at the Allentown Fairgrounds, and I also know that Jan Hammer opened up for one of them. But I still don't know which exactly was my first concert. But that was way back when I was a wee lad of about 16, when I got to my first concert. So let us know what you saw that you liked, you didn't like, that you were going to go see during this pandemic, but it got scrubbed. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. How magical. All right. I also know that the person I've seen the absolute most, believe it or not, is Anais Mitchell. I've seen her solo. I've seen her on First Nights. I have seen her at Langdon Street Cafe. There were a group of female artists who did a Dylan night. I think it was a Dylan night. And I've also seen her with Bonnie Light Horseman. So I'm guessing that I've seen Anais Mitchell about a dozen times and really have enjoyed every time I've gotten to see her live. All right, let's start on the phones, and we'll begin with Sterling. Hey, Sterling, how are you doing?
Hey, Rick, good morning. You know, you jog my memory. I'm driving down the road, and I'm trying to think, well, who's that band I saw at Memorial Auditorium all those years ago? It was the summer of 1977. I graduated high school. I had graduated high school, and I was working for a fence company that's no longer around. Supertramp played at the Memorial Auditorium in Burlington.
Oh, wow.
And I took a girl from Plainfield. I know her name. I won't say it on the radio.
Please,
I don't know where she is or whatever happened to her. She was a friend of a bunch of friends I knew. She's a wonderful girl. You know, it's like she's one of those persons I wish I never lost contact with in life. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But it was insane. People were trying to climb the fire escapes to get in. There was too many people in the building. It was wild.
Wow.
It was wild. It was like 1977. It was insane, man. It was crazy.
Good show?
Oh, it was wicked good, but the tension was like, it was, because it...
Now we've lost Sterling. All right, let's check in with Fred. I think it's Fred from Newbury next. Hey, Fred, go right ahead.
It's very interesting. I thought Joe, the president, was for the working man and woman. And so what Joe does first thing off
is
cancel the pipeline and cancel the pipeline. I mean, that really got me confused. Does it confuse you?
Well, you know, that's your point is well taken. It is definitely a case of does that help the working man, or is he making a move because of the potential environmental impacts?
But what's more important? Some guy with a job, he needs a job today. He doesn't need to worry about the environment tomorrow.
Right. Well,
and the kicker is, Joe said, he can make solar cells. I mean, how stupid can you be? I mean, I work with my hands, and I'm going to make solar cells. How long is it going to take to train me to do that? And then who's going to pay me while I'm being trained? And how much is that going to cost?
Yeah, I understand, Fred, that you'd prefer to have that XL pipeline. That was a move that Joe made, part of his platform. And he elected with that, what he could say, is that directive from the people who elected him. Great question. And we'll have hundreds, if not thousands, over the next 4 years, Fred, to look at and say, is this the right direction of the country? And in 4 years, we get to decide again what we think is the right direction. Is it to have the XL pipeline and those jobs that are connected to that? Is it to protect the environment and not have the XL pipeline? So you bring up a great question. Our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Open phones until 10:30. At that point, we're going to talk to a couple who run you're not going to believe this, frankincense and myrrh distillery in Colchester, and we'll hear from them. I had no idea that one existed here in Vermont. Our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Talking music or talking whatever subject you'd like to talk about here in the next half hour. Now, let's see. I told you my first concert. I told you the person I've seen the most, Anais Mitchell, from right here in Vermont, from Middlebury. Really enjoyed all the times I've gotten to see her. Now, my most memorable is I was at the Who concert in December 1979 in Cincinnati, a rather infamous show when 12 people died in the crush to get into that concert there in Cincinnati, Ohio. Unfortunately, the kind of entrance and crush to get into that concert was indicative to the way a lot of the concerts there in that area seemed to go. And unfortunately, the festival seating in a 17,000-seat arena that night was not the best approach. And we all knew that before time, but that's the way the promoters went with it. They didn't have to have people checking to make sure you're in the right seat. And the resulting 12 deaths really changed things in how concerts were held in Cincinnati and probably throughout the world after that. It was a great show, but there was a kind of a cloud hanging over it because you feared that someone He thought maybe one person had died. In the end, 12 people had died in that evening in Cincinnati, Ohio. We're going to go back to the phones now and speak with John this time from Burlington. Hi, John.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
I can. Go right ahead.
Okay, well, one of the previous callers mentioned Memorial Auditorium.
Yep.
This was quite a bit before 77, and it was something that I just walked into because I think it was Champlain College was having just a spring dance or spring event, and they brought a band that wasn't too bad. And the band was called the Chicago Transit Authority.
Oh, my goodness.
And I just walked into that concert, and they were just kind of coming onto the scene, and they really, they were great, as they were for many years after.
Did they have the horn section?
Oh, absolutely, yes, yep. And that was kind of, you know, for rock and roll, I think the horns were something that were kind of new.
Yeah. Absolutely. Chicago Transit Authority eventually shortened their name to Chicago, and that's how most of us known through them, you know, all these years. They really hit it big with 25 to 6 or 4, and what was the other one? Saturday in the Park, maybe?
Yeah.
I'd sing it for you, John, but then they'd have to take me off this show forever, so we'll just let it go from there. Hey, thanks, John, for calling. Back to the phones, and Ray's first. Hi, Ray.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, Ray.
Well, you ready for my story?
I am.
All right. This goes way back to 1956.
Wow.
And my buddy had just got his license, and he had a convertible, and I was living in Rochester, Vermont. He rolls up in the yard and says, hey, Ray, what are you doing tonight? And I said, oh, I don't know, not much. Let's go to Mel's Bay. He's up there in Burlington somewhere. He said, they got a really good band. I said, well, sure, you know, 16, on the rest, go. And I was all for it, you know.
Yep.
So we scraped up a little money, got in their horse, and rode off up to Mellis Bay. Neither one of us had ever been there. And we finally found a place, and the yard was packed solid. And, you know, finally got up and got our tickets and worked our way down toward the front. It was a big place. Just a million people. And we finally wiggled and squeezed, and finally I got right up front, a foot away from the stage. And there on stage was Louis Armstrong.
Whoa.
And I had never heard of him in my life. But my friend was a trumpet player, and, you know, he told me, oh, this guy's real great, you're going to like him. Well, you know, I come from Booneyville, and we played pop music and country and stuff like that. And so I said, yeah, that sounds good. He was playing. And there was Louis Armstrong, who I'd never heard of, just blew me away.
Oh,
I heard that Dixieland sound for the first time in my life. I said, holy mackerel, what did they dig that? You know, so I just want to say that sometimes you never know what you're going to walk into, but that was an experience I've never, ever forgot in my life. I realized how famous he was. He was born in, I think, 1901, so he was probably 55 or 6 somewhere there. He was at his prime, and his band was so, so good. It influenced my life, and I didn't play trumpet, but I ended up playing the saxophone.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, but it influenced me. So that was one of my good experiences doing something I didn't know what I was getting into until I got there.
Great story, Ray, and a great example. I hope after this pandemic we all realize, you know, get out and see live music, support local artists, and you just never know what you're going to experience, how it will influence you and your tastes and expose you to something wonderful. What a great story from Ray. We go to Jim next. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning. I'm wondering if your listeners, some of your listeners have had kind of the same experience that I have, and also whether anyone's ever heard of a venue called the Boston Tea Party in Boston, of course. But my experience is that I graduated high school in 71, and all of these concerts were while I was in high school. Mm-hmm. But what amazes me is that I have two nephews. They're both in their 30s now. But, you know, when they were 18, 20 years old, they were listening to some of the same bands that was so big when I was a kid. And I'm just wondering about that era. Now, some of these bands were like the Grateful Dead, saw them at Boston Tea Party, Led Zeppelin, saw them twice, The Who, The Doors, Jimi Hendrix. And these people are still legend. Or these bands are still legendary today. And that's what kind of amazed me. The thing about this Boston Tea Party was it was a non-alcohol nightclub. And it was run by the owners of WBCM, which was a kind of a sort of a hard rock, I don't know what you want to call it, sort of an alternative radio station back in the 60s. But are you familiar with it?
I know it only by reputation.
Yeah, it's gone now, I'm sure. But it was kind of a real psychedelic type of era. But anyway, like the Grateful Dead, I saw in the Boston Tea Party, and we were sitting right there. We could touch their toes. Led Zeppelin, I saw in Hampton Beach Casino, and you could walk up to the stage. It was probably chest high, and you could touch their toes. Six months later, I saw Led Zeppelin in the Boston Garden, and there was 50 million people there. It was totally different. But in the summer, Led Zeppelin was, I don't know what that was, 68, 69, something like that. But in the summer, they were a big band, but not that big. But by the time February rolled around, they were huge. I saw The Who in the Boston Tea Party. They were right there. I mean, the stage was 2 feet off the ground, and you could sit in the chair right in front of it. But anyway, what I'm wondering about is, what is it about that era? Or is it just happens to be the era that I'm familiar with? Or, you know, it just seems like the Grateful Dead was huge until just a few years ago, actually. Still are, but I mean, they broke up.
Yeah. Well, Jim, this is a great point, and it's probably why our sister station, WCVT, has listeners. But that era, the 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, maybe even in the 90s, but really so much great rock and unique rock came out then that's just not being made as much today. And so, you know, the kids, your nephews, finding that that indeed, you know, is the era, a real sweet spot of rock music. And unfortunately, I'm not sure we're going to see that again. I would love to see another wave of that. Okay, we got a few more minutes, a few more calls, so let's get moving. We're going to go to Paula next. Hi, Paula.
Hi. I have a story about Simon and Garfunkel.
Oh, I love it. Go right ahead.
I was in high school in Detroit, and there was a great music venue, the Masonic Auditorium. And I went with my best friend, and of course, we were swooning through the whole concert. And I kept saying to myself, I have to meet them, I have to meet them, I have to meet them. So they announced on stage at the end of the concert that they would be signing autographs, and they described where it would be in the auditorium. And so I grabbed my friend, I said, come on. And she said, what are you saying? And I just said, come. So we just started running, and I knew where the place was where they were going to be. And, of course, nobody could be back there until they let everybody in. So I took out my high school ID card, and I flashed it in front of somebody, and I said, press. And they let us in. And there are Simon and Garfunkel standing in back of a table. They had just come off stage. They had just gotten in back of the table. And they're standing there, and we're all alone.
Oh, Paula.
Except for a few press members. And they said, what the heck are you doing here? And I told them what I did. And they said, Paul Simon said, Artie, you know, this really calls for a gift. So they took a post off the wall that had been in the hallway there in back of them, and they signed it, and they gave it to me.
Oh, Paula.
They said, you better get out of here now. I said, okay, I know where to go. The second story is a Bonnie Raitt concert. At Michigan State, they used to have these rooms called kivas in the dormitory complexes, and they were there for discussion for classes, and they had a bunch of different musicians coming in. Bonnie Raitt came in with Freebo, her bass player, just the two of them all alone.
Oh, my.
And they gave a concert on a Friday night that went on and on and on forever, and I was in the front row. I could have touched her. It was amazing.
Well, okay. Your point is well taken. It's something that Jim had mentioned, too, about being so close to bands that we don't get to anymore. And, you know, there have been things happening like someone jumping on the stage and walking towards the band, and then the roadies have to take them off. And, you know, that kind of took out that ability to be closer to bands than we used to be, and that's unfortunate. All right, let's see if we can get through the last couple calls. Tom, you're next. Go ahead, Tom.
Hey, good morning.
How you doing?
That's good. That's great timing on the being close, because I don't think this story has any relevance other than that. I'm a lifelong Springsteen fan, and 2 years ago, my kids bought my wife and I tickets to Broadway, and that experience being that close, I mean, they were the worst seats in the house there, but, I mean, 400 people, you're with him, and I had just read his book, and it's pretty much that anthology played, strictly pretty much on the piano. It's just completely different and special, you know?
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
Great story, Tom. Thanks so much. All right, let's try to get one more in. Katrina has joined us. Hi, Katrina.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good. How you doing?
I am okay. Good. I have two college time concerts.
Make them quick.
That you might find of interest.
All right.
Probably in 62 or 63 at college, there was this unknown harmonica guitar guy that was the warm-up act for the blind Reverend Gary Davis. And who was it but Bob Dylan?
Oh, boy.
And he was selling his albums back in the hall, a soul figure. I couldn't even afford that to buy one.
Oh, my.
And the other, in 1963, the summer of 63, the March on Washington,
mm-hmm.
the night before, Peter, Paul, and Mary did a concert on the grounds of Walter Reed Hospital in a small amphitheater.
Hmm.
And they dedicated their performance to the people that made tomorrow possible, meaning the big march on Washington.
That's fantastic. Wow. Dylan as a warm-up, Peter, Paul, and Mary at the Walter Reed Hospital before the march on Washington.
Yeah.
Those are great stories. Great memories. Thanks so much, Katrina. And thanks to everyone who's called in. Boy, these special moments, they stick with us forever, don't they? Most beautiful concert I ever saw was Queen, News of the World Tour, back in December of 1977 in Dayton, Ohio. And saw Freddie Mercury. I had the pleasure, and it was absolutely stunning for a rock concert. Just beautiful. All right, that'll do it for now. We'll do this again sometime. I want to thanks to all of you who called in this morning. We're going to pop out for a CBS News break, then come back to chat about frankincense and myrrh. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we're raising our hats to the good presidents past and present with a sale. 20% off all men's and women's fall winter clothing. Our deli is pumping out amazing deliciousness with old favorites like the number 6 and some new specialties like the best Reuben anywhere in Vermont. The grab-and-go dinners are a great value, generous full-course meals for two. Check out warrenstore.com for weekly menus and to order online. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly, the Warren Store in Warren Village is open 7:30 to 5 daily, practicing all COVID protocols.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. You're probably starting to get the idea that my interests range from left of the bizarre to right of the arcane. So when I saw that Vermont has a frankincense and myrrh distillery, I just had to learn more. I didn't even know that they were processed in a distillery. I'm not sure what I thought. But Bus Wellness in Colchester does exactly that. And they have a very specific reason for being in the frankincense and myrrh business. We're going to learn all about that. Joining me now are the co-founders of Bus Wellness, Jamie Garvey. Welcome, Jamie.
Hi.
Hi there.
Rick. Thanks for having us.
And Mahadi Ibrahim. It's nice to have you here as well.
Thank you, Rick. I'm glad to be here, too.
Good. And listeners, if you have questions about frankincense and myrrh, or if you use it, give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right. Who do I start with? Mahadi, what exactly is frankincense and myrrh?
Frankincense and myrrh are tree sap. Come from a tree called Commiphora, myrrh, and Boswellia tree.
Two different trees they come from?
Yes.
All right.
Two different trees.
And although they always seem to be grouped together, thanks to the magi, they're two different things. Do they smell much different from one another?
Yeah, definitely they do. They have the myrrh have a kind of bitter smell, and the frankincense have a more pleasant smell.
Hmm. All right. And can they be enjoyed separately?
Definitely, they can. Usually, we don't mix them in my culture, both of them burning. We do burn the frankincense for spiritual, for, you know, helping to decrease bacteria in the air.
Mm.
So, and the myrrh, it's more, it's a repellent. We have it in my house back home just because of snakes. It repels snakes.
They repel snakes.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. So, Jamie, when did you learn about frankincense and myrrh?
Well, I'm raised Catholic, so, of course, I knew about it from the Bible and
right.
smelled it in church on Christmas and all of that. So that was the extent of my knowledge. But, you know, when I got together with Mahdi and then we were trying to think of a business idea. He came up with the idea of bringing frankincense over to Vermont, and he did all of this research on it. And so that was kind of my deep introduction to it. And that was like around 2004.
Did you?
I really didn't know anything about it.
Yeah. Did you look at him and say, frankincense and myrrh, really?
Even my mom thought I was losing my mind.
Well, Mahdi, tell us, now you're from Somaliland, is that correct?
Yes.
All right, so tell us, you know, about, in your culture, you know, did you know about frankincense and myrrh, you know, from a young age and, you know, more than just the Bible story?
You know, we grew up Muslim,
mm-hmm.
and we burn daily in my in my house. My mom usually, until today, she burned daily. And, you know, I was just thinking about to help back home and what kind of community I could bring it in. So my dad passed away in 2002, and when I came back, I just started dreaming about his head and the smoke of frankincense.
Hmm.
And that's what, you know, started me to go that route. And then when I told my mom, she thought I was going crazy. and she sent me the first 2 pounds of resin, and we start, you know, putting it in small bags and trying to sell to stores, and that's how I started. And then I realized it could be possible to have oil. And the more I did research and just found that there is a frankincense oil, and I'm like, oh. So that's why how I started, and, you know, I realized that the oil are more valuable than the raw material after you distill.
Hmm. So what year, Jamie, did Bus Wellness get started?
2004.
When we
initially started, yep.
So you've been in the frankincense and myrrh industry here in Vermont for 17 years?
Yeah, believe it or not.
And I'm just finding out about this. So, I know it's not a product that, you know, we go to the store and buy very often. But, you know, what kind of pushed you over the edge to say, okay, you know, Mahdi, I agree. Let's start a company that distills frankincense and myrrh. How did he convince you that this was an actual business venture worth going into?
Well, he literally spent like countless hours researching the distillation and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So just how much work he put into his research and then telling me like, hey, this is actually a thing, frankincense essential oil. I mean, we knew nothing about essential oils. But, you know, I realized that, oh, well, I guess maybe you're onto something. And then he was like, well, I think we need to go to Somaliland and, you know, go to the harvest region and like start this the right way and meet the people. And, and so I was all in. And I mean, it took us a long time to get off the ground, a long, long time.
Sure.
So I definitely had my days where I was like, yeah, I don't know about this. But here we are, so I'm glad I stuck with it.
Well, and, you know, I'm looking at 2004, you mentioned essential oils. 2021, you mentioned essential oils. Not so weird. 2004, I'm not sure essential oils were much of a thing yet, were they?
Not in the mainstream, but there's definitely been, even back then, a community that uses them,
yeah.
I would say. Yeah.
Well, I think Mahdi is a visionary in 2002, 2004. You know, to be talking about essential oils. Now, the idea of a distillery, it sounds a little strange to me when we talk about frankincense and myrrh because it's not a spirit. So, Mahdi, let's talk about, you know, why this has to be distilled and how frankincense and myrrh get distilled.
Definitely. It's, you know, way back they used to use plants to distill to get the medicinal part of the plant. So that's what in the chemistry, you know, from solid to liquid, that was something like who came right away in my head. And I was like, oh, maybe we just need to melt it and evaporate it and condense and get it back, that volatile oil to turn to steam to back to liquid. And that's what, bingo, that's what the liquid gold came out.
Oh, so not unlike an actual spirit. So distilling, you create the vapor and then that steam, you then capture the liquid. So tell me, like, how big a distillery is this in Colchester?
It's a 200-gallon kettle distillery. And we put, like, around, you know, 60 gallons of water. We commingle, we cook it for around 6 to 7 hours. And then while that process is going, we condense. We have a big condenser where the PVC, stainless steel pipes surround the water where the steam go through to cool it down, to bring it back to liquid. And then we have a separator where the water and the oil come together. So water, we have a byproduct, water, frankincense water. And that doesn't mix. Water and oil won't never mix. So the oil always stay on the top.
Uh-huh.
And then we pour out the oil from the top.
Now, it definitely sounds like this is, you know, it takes some amount of, I would say, chemistry. So do either of you have a background that makes sense to become a distiller?
Not really. It was the basic chemistry we learn in high school.
Yeah.
The distillation. It wasn't really a rock scientist. The first distillation happened in the year 1000. That's what I found in my research.
Hmm.
So it wasn't, they used to do it in the lake, put the condenser in the lake so they could catch the oil.
Oh, I gotcha. Jamie, if you didn't become a frankincense and myrrh distiller, what were you on the road to becoming? Did you have a career in mind before this happened or no?
Not really. I wasn't really sure. I worked in, an account manager for a time.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty boring stuff.
Not like making frankincense and myrrh at all. And so we were talking about some of the products, Jamie, before, and you mentioned essential oils. What other things do you make there at Bus Wellness?
So besides the essential oils, we do something called hydrosol, which, as Mahdi mentioned earlier, is there's a water byproduct of the distillation process, and that water is called hydrosol in, like, the aromatherapy and cosmetic world, and it contains all of the great properties that frankincense and myrrh have in the oil and the resin. So we sell that. We, of course, sell resin. And then we make a powder extract from the frankincense that's used in various ways in cosmetic preparations, but also some people use it in capsules for different ailments.
Hmm. Do you sell directly to the public?
Yeah, we do. Admittedly, more than 95% of our business is wholesale, business to business, but Our goal when we started this was like to have quality frankincense and myrrh essential oils available to the general public, like easily accessible straight from the distiller, because that's pretty rare. There's a lot of adulterated products on the market. So we put it on our website. We do have a web store where people can buy it in smaller quantities.
And you mentioned wholesale. So the other businesses that purchase this from you, what do they create? What do they make with it?
Aside from like aromatherapy companies who just have like a line of, you know, all the oils that they sell, and then they repackage our frankincense under their label. I mean, that's one thing. But also cosmetic companies, frankincense is great for your skin. Myrrh is too, but frankincense is more well known. And so it's great for like treating aging skin and wrinkles. So skincare is big in frankincense, but they use it for face serums and creams and all sorts of stuff.
Now, I understand. I have always grown up calling it frankincense and myrrh. You're pronouncing it myrrh. I'm not sure you're going to ever correct me, but is that the correct pronunciation of it?
Yeah, I mean, it's myrrh. Common form myrrh is like the Latin name. So I think everybody says myrrh in this country, and I just have become used to pronouncing it the way Mahdi does, which is
near. Yeah. Okay, good. That's a good explanation. So I'm wrong with the rest of America, and I'll probably will be for a long time. Mahdi, I want to talk about frankincense and myrrh in the religious tradition. I come from the Catholic tradition as well, and that incense. And you mentioned that, you know, you're Muslim. Is it used in religious ceremonies in the Muslim religion and others?
Oh, yeah. I think this is the only thing we have all in common. It's frankincense. And even my mom didn't know the Catholics use frankincense. She was very surprised.
Yeah.
But when I look at it, it's in the Torah, in the Bible, in the Quran. Even the Buddhism use frankincense. They make incense from it.
Yeah.
To burn. So it's really the only thing we all have in common.
That's interesting. Now, is it used in cures at all?
Oh, yeah. You know, when we used to have a stomach upset or stomach problem, my mom used to soak the myrrh in water for a few hours and make us drink that water. And then really the stomach pain and all that would be gone.
Do you still do that?
Oh, yeah, I have it at home, a small bottle, too.
Oh, I love it.
And if you have a wound, too, it's a good thing. If you got a cut, you just put a paste, the paste of the myrrh and water on the cut, and it will seal your cut.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's go back to the source. Jamie, where do you get your frankincense and myrrh from before distilling it?
So we get it from Somaliland in the Aragavo Sanag region, actually. Aragavo is a village, but it's called the Sanag region. And it's like northeast Somaliland on the Horn. So it's on the Gulf of Aden. And so we get it from multiple cooperatives there that we work with. And it gets here by container ship. First, I would say Mahdi's brother is like the head of sourcing there, so that's lucky for us. We have him on the ground there working with the harvesters and securing our resins. And then they come on a container ship into the port of Montreal, and we truck them down here.
And you've still been able to get it through customs during the pandemic, I would take, because it's a business transaction.
Yep, we were able to.
Yep.
Exactly.
We're kind of a little famous at the border.
I bet.
When they open the container, they know it's for us. The smell.
I bet.
Avoid it.
Oh, I love it. Mahdi, how have you been able to help people back in Somaliland?
That was my dream when I started this business, to do something better for them. And we did, we did the four wells. With solar panels and solar pumps. And we purchased finally a hydraulic drill. We brought it there, so it's much easier instead of digging by hand. We could do it hydraulically, and that since the coronavirus, everything kind of slowed down and stopped. But we're hoping to do more wells as soon the war settles with the coronavirus.
Yeah. Now tell us about Somaliland. This is not Somalia. So explain the difference and give us a little history, you know, a little bit of what your country is like there.
Yes. Somaliland was colonized by the British, and Somalia was colonized by the Italians. That's why it's Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a dictatorship for 30 years, and in 1981, there's a Somaliland National Movement was created to get rid of the dictator. And finally, in 1988, that was the first time the rebellion came and pushed the military, the dictatorship, out. And since 91, we declared it as an independent country. But we're not recognized worldwide. And the United Nations doesn't really recognize as a country, but as a, you know, Somaliland is more separated from Somalia.
And so is there a separate government or even a regional government that Somaliland has?
We have a president. We have a president. We have a parliament. We have military. We have a police. So it's really a unique place in Africa who created their own democracy.
Mm. Wow. All right. The name of the company is Bus Wellness, Frankincense and Myrrh. And Jamie, the name Bus Wellness, explain the name, what it means and why you chose it.
Sure. So frankincense comes from the Boswellia tree. And we are in the wellness industry. Mm-hmm. So Bus Wellness just seemed fitting.
It is indeed. And you mentioned that you've been around since 2004. So how has the company grown in that 17-year stretch?
So like I alluded to earlier, it took us a long time to get off the ground. And in the beginning, you know, we really weren't getting anywhere. and so... In around 2011, it was really getting to a point where we were like, okay, we either have to like figure something out or we can't go on because we weren't making any profit at all.
Mm-hmm.
And 7 years in, you know. So we were lucky to be contacted by this company, which probably a lot of people have heard of, called Lush.
Yeah.
They have stores all over the world, and they're like a, you know, handmade cosmetic / soap company. They reached out to us. They found us online, and it was like a miracle, really.
Oh, wow.
They started buying from us and in, you know, significant quantities, and that allowed us to start growing and, you know, going to trade shows and meeting new people in the industry and just kind of growing from there.
Wow, I love that. Lush, I remember the first one I ever went to was over in the UK, and they had the bath bombs and the whole thing. And
exactly.
Now I'm happy I walked in and bought some stuff from them. Jamie Garvey and Mahdi Ibrahim are co-founders of Bus Wellness Frankincense and Myrrh Distillery in Colchester. The website is buswellness.com. I want to thank you both for being on the program this morning.
Thanks so much, Rick.
Thank you, Rick, for having us.
Yes, it's my pleasure. And that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. I do want to flip back to our concert talk. Charlie wrote in. He said he went to the Moody Blues in 1973 at the Montreal Coliseum. He said it was an awakening for a Vermont farm boy. I absolutely love it. Thanks to everybody who listened and called in today. I'm Rick Singeri. This is Vermont Viewpoint. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.